Thank you very much. I want to thank the organizer for the opportunity, in particular Victor, who probably going to show up soon. Today we're talking about the I will talk about the possible new phases of atomic matter with or without lattice. And I'll basically touch up two topics. The first one will be on the unconventional vortex property of a gapless fermion superfluid. Then the second one we'll talk about the orbital order of the p-band bosons on the lattice. Okay, that's the second one is on the lattice. So in particular, I want to thank the funding support from Oak Ridge and also from the ARO. In particular, the ARO is my first major grant, so I'm very happy and kind of encouraged. Let me start with topic A. So this is about the unconventional property of the bridged pair superfluidity. In short, I would call BP state. This part of the talk is based on the work I've done with the following people. Michael Forbes was a student at MIT, now actually in Seattle. Gamon Kova is still at MIT, I believe, and Professor Jamal King here, Frank Wurczek at MIT, and my student Vladimir, who's in the audience right here. Also with Peter Zoller. Here are the publications. There was a news report on the actually physical review focus. If you like, you can browse a little bit over there. Let me give a brief remark on the bridged pair superfluidity. Then I will directly go to a recent work I did with my student and also Professor Yang-Bei King on the vortex properties. So let me, I'm not going to go over many properties about this state because it's already understood by many people already. So I will just use a few slides to point out the difference or some kind of confusions in the community. So first of all, why we call it bridged? Because it's kind of historically related to the Sommer phase, which will become your next slide. So let me just show you that to justify the name by looking at the wave functions. Okay. So here I show the two kind of wave functions. One is the conventional BCS, as well as the BP wave function. And the difference is right here in the momentum space. There's an unpaired matter. That matter actually consists only one kind of spin. So in this case, I assume it's more part in down spin in this wave function. So that those guys live in this bridge in the momentum space because if you evaluate all the parameter in the momentum space, in the zero temperature, that all the parameter is precisely zero. That's why we call it bridge. That's actually the bridge is bounded by these two points, actually indicated by P plus minus delta. And that actually is very simple to understand now. Now let me point out the essential difference between SAMO and the BP state. So let me just summarize what SAMO did actually in comparison with what we did actually. By the way, actually I did not know SAMO's paper actually when I wrote my own. So that's, I mean, with Frank Wurczek. So let me just emphasize the essential difference. The first one, when SAMO started his paper, so he only considered the case of equal masses. Okay, this is very important. And of course, he introduced this thereby cutoff, like a BCS model, to regularize the theory. However, he did not pay attention to the new possibility that actually the delta Kf greater than the thereby cutoff divided by Fermi velocity, where delta Kf is the Fermi momentum difference between up and down Fermi surfaces. Okay. And of course, he was correct to conclude the state is unstable. And what we did actually is kind of rediscover the interest of this imbalance, basically the pairing with mismatched Fermi surfaces. And I believe it's fair to say we first introduced the effect of mass imbalance, basically the mass ratio effect. We of course use this momentum cutoff. Actually, we really realized that the interest of the case that delta Kf greater than that, the cutoff momentum, lambda. So this is very important, essential to make this state stable. And of course, I want to publicly admit one mistake I made in this larger PIO paper in 2003. Actually, not. So the calculation was okay, but the conclusion was incorrect. Because we did not, in this case, we consider a very general model like a delta interaction without any momentum cutoff. In other case, actually, we tried to find out if it's possible in this very general situation, actually related to the contact interaction, contacts and cold atoms, to stabilize the system by fixing the density. However, we made a mistake. I made a mistake not including the possibility of phase separations, which was pointed out by others later on. So that was one mistake for the conclusion. So the calculation was okay. Of course, after we first point out this new possibility in 2003, actually we first post paper on it in summer of 2002. They have a number of theoretical papers, and I want to introduce two papers which actually criticize what we did. This is about the phase separation I already explained, which is this paper actually by Wen Yip was actually about the superfree density. Both papers are correct. I mean, the conclusions are correct. However, both are done for the short-range delta interaction. It's like in a momentum space, there's no momentum dependence. It's just a constant. That is very important. And our paper, actually, our first PIL actually remained correct. And actually, the stability issue was clarified in this late 2005 PIL. What we found is the following. So the BP state is stable when the interaction is of finite or long range or a momentum cutoff. And this kind of momentum cutoff is more like a theoretical toy model. So maybe talking about the finite range for the more real system. So if you're talking about the real system, if you think about the effect range, let me indicate it by R star, we need actually the R star comparable with the Fermi wavelength. That is the criterion. And that actually is possible if you look at some narrow resonance for some system, like in Lison 6. This is a different resonance than those widely studied. It's also known as like a wide resonance. That's actually happened to be A to B equal to 840 something. In that order. If you look at the R star is like in a micron, actually in the narrow resonance case, indeed actually like Rick has done a lot of calculation on the narrow resonance, the R star is very large. In that case, effectively you can have long range comparable with the, it's actually even longer in this case, the interparticle distance. Let me just summarize quickly the major ingredients, actually the conditions to stabilize the BP state. That is, you need two conditions. First one, you need unequal masses. Secondly, you need a moment-dependent structure in the interaction. So those details are actually given in our late PIL paper. Now let me directly go into the more interesting case now for the strongly carbonyl imbalanced Fermi gases with spin up and down the population is said in balance. Of course, there are. Yes?
I just didn't catch the. Do you always have a different density of the two species?
You can make the density same or a lot of the same. So, unlike the electronic system, here, this you only have actually two separate conservations, like two U1 symmetries. And in the electronic system, you have larger symmetries, like one SU2 spin plus one total charge. This is the kind of. Okay. You can also drive a coherence, but in general, if you don't drive a coherence, you have a to separate the conservation loss, and then there's no automatic conversion between up and downs. That is very important. So this is the typical situation. Yeah. So answer your question.
Yeah, it was the simpler question. The first few words you said were
enough. Okay. So they basically there were a lot of studies about this strongly interacting Fermi gases with population imbalance. There was a lot of papers before the phase separation work by Wolfgang Kettle and Brent Hewlett. There was even longer list of papers after these two experiments. Actually, I can find out by looking at the citation record, so it's like a lot of studies. I'm not gonna list all of that. So, however, in the case of strong carbonyl, you can really realize a new kind of bridged pairing. Here is already a cartoon picture I showed you in the previous slide. This is like the case when you have weak carbonyl. If you have long range or some kind of momentum-dependent interaction, you can really realize this possibility. However, in a strong carbonyl case, you can realize the case with one single Fermi surface. Okay, and this is another new possibility if you include the mass effect. So I'm not going to talk about this case today. Not many people explore that one. Some people already studied a little bit, but not much. So I mostly focus on this particular case. This is the one Fermi surface BP state. Okay.
Can you explain what do you mean by weak and strong?
The interaction is very strong, so that you can ignore the real normalization to the chemical potential. Your Fermi surface is really, okay, after the pairing, your Fermi surface is really strongly deformed from your free particle Fermi surface.
Okay.
So it's not a small perturbation. In the BCS case, the delta is so small you can ignore any change of the firm surface, I mean the chemical potential, basically. So it's very strong such that they change to the okay, you can drive. In this case, actually, the chemical potential becomes a negative. You can drive because of the strong interaction.
Weak strong, you compare two entities, you're attacking against the
fluid. Okay, if the interaction is really weak, it's sufficiently weak, your mu by itself is positive. And it's actually, it's like a mu.
BCS.
It's like BCS, so the correction is like a delta square delta. So it's very small because delta is small in other case. But in this case, it's not because it's really, it's actually not only, it's not a small change, it changes the sign, so it's very qualitative. So these are the Bogner of quasi particles spectrum. Delta is the energy gap due to the pairing. The gap you can think about is the gap between these two guys, between the top and bottom, but the low branch in this case you see is gapless. There's only one Fermi surface. And in this case you could have two Fermi surfaces. That is the difference between these two bridged pair states. And in particular, this is called magnetized superfluid or many other names in the Boulder school, like Neil, Dan, and they call this magnetized superfluid. So that section I'm going to talk about that. Let me introduce the phase diagram. This is there are many versions of phase diagram. The one I'm going to use is kind of related to what we are going to study in the vortex property. So that's why I use this one. This is like a phase diagram proposed by Sohn Steffeloff based on the effect field theory approach. Okay. This is like a proposed universal phase diagram, but it's not you don't really want to pinpoint the numbers. This is like an effect field theory approach. So this line is almost like a 1 over KFA. That's the Fermian line if I reinterpret it in that language. And this blue dashed line is like the unitary regime. Okay. This is the BEC and the last BCS. And if you, in particular, I want to pay attention, in particular, emphasize these two states, basically the BP1 and BP2, and separated by these dashed lines here. Okay. So that was the proposal, finding based on the effect field theory approach by Sohn Steffeloff. And of course, this result, by the way, this eta measures the imbalance, of course, in terms of the chemical potential difference. Okay. And you can.
But somehow, as eta is changing in the BCS phase, the particle number is not changing. Okay, that's how I understand it.
Say again.
So as your eta is increasing, but you are still in the BCS phase, the lowest phase on this diagram, the actual number of spin up and spin down fermions is not changing.
So this one, in this case, the total number may change because you change your chemical potential. However, below this line, so basically in this BEC, BCS superfluid is unpolarized. So the population imbalance is precisely zero. Even the eta is not zero, even if it's finite delta mu. Okay. Because the BCS state can sustain up to a finite effective magnetic field. Beyond which, as long as the Clarkson, what's the name? I never know how to pronounce the name. This Clarkson limit, which is basically Q to BCS state, right? Of course, there are many other versions. I'm not going to show all of them. So many authors contributed to this. None of them by me, actually. This is like I already mentioned, actually, this is the same. The BP1 state in my language is the same as like a magnetized superfluid by Dan Shi and Neil Razhovsky. There are also many other various names, and the name I used actually was not invented by me. Actually, by I think it's due to Dawn. I just adapted from the paper they called BP1, so I called it BP1. So it's not my own invention. I did not make a BP1 name by myself. And there are many people who contributed to this. The one important ingredient I want you to take home is that BP1 is kind of predicted to be on the BEC molecular side, not on the resonance region, but near the resonance region all the way to the extreme limit of BEC. The existence of BP1 is actually, to some extent, it's very easy to understand. Because if you really go to the BEC region, you really have some kind of molecules that want to condense. for the molecules that we can interact in, if they're far away from for the resonance region, what they can do? For we can dilute both gas, so of course they will condense. So the existence to some extent is quite robust and also easy to understand. So it's not difficult in this case. However, what I'm going to show is that the property of this state is very remarkable. That is the point. Okay.
So in this case, it's a phase separated.
No, it's not separated. It's uniform in the real space. It's a phase separated in momentum space. Otherwise, it's uniform in the real space. So if you start with the BCS side, you change your magnetic field, you cross over to the BEC side. As soon as you kill the phase separation window, you get into this state. I mean, if you fix polarization. So that's the one. So now let me directly go to a recent work I did with my student Vladimir and Professor Yang-Bei Kim, who is both are in the audience. So basically, yes.
Transitions are as function of chemical potential or magnetization, Zeeman field or first order in the
Let me show. Let me go back. So here, so from here to here.
On the left.
Here.
Yeah, and then just go vertically. Both lines are first order.
So this will be this will be the second order phase transition. You go to the normal state. This is a normal state. Mm-hmm. This is the continued symmetry broken situation. However, from here to here will be first order.
You sure this one's also
second? Okay. I didn't study this one. For a mean field, I would conclude this is the second order. Okay, because you fix the chemical potential, you do not talk about the phase separations. If you fix the densities, you can talk about the phase separations. Phase separation will be in this window here, with one point and on the fixed mu. This is like a fixed chemical potential, okay.
So if you're saying I recall for equal masses, that second one is also first order.
So you mean this one is first order? Yeah.
I have a hard time understanding why either of them is first order, because you'd imagine that. Yeah. You start creating extra fermions, and then in the end, you have all extra fermions. But the bottom line is the line where you start adding fermions in addition to molecules. If you're on the far left of this diagram going up, and the top line is where you have no molecules left, you only have fermions. So if there's a jump, then you're saying there's a jump in the fermion number. But suddenly you create a certain number of fermions, and then suddenly all molecules disappear at once across the line. If there's a first order transition.
I would think about this one is like if I stay back to both your question and especially in Leon's question, suppose I focus on this particular line here. I mean, it's far BEC limit. I have kind of a weakly dilute interacting both gas.
Yeah.
I have some kind of unpaired fermion, say spin up, and all the interactions are very weak. So if I focus on the both gas, I would think they should undergo second order phase transition to the Bose condensate.
I don't remember, but vaguely remember.
So that would be
some couplings between the pairs and the fermions, and at least energy density coupling, density.
Uh-huh.
So since the fermions are gapless, if you imagine doing a Landau expansion and the boson order parameter, eventually you hit non-analytic terms.
Yeah, probably if you go beyond the mean field, probably for this part, I still think if the interaction is weak, if you regard it as like weak carbon and like it's a perturbation, if you do little large, probably it's kind of irrelevant in that case, the carbon will not change the university class.
See it in mean field. I don't remember.
Okay.
About these things for exotonic insulators.
Mm-hmm. But I have never studied this transition yet, so I'm not sure.
I think this is in my paper with Subir. Actually, I don't remember the detail, but I'm pretty sure it's Subir wrote that part, by the way. I think it's second order. And there are non-analytic contributions, but I think both are second order. Both Lipschitz,
I think if there are, there will be some logarithm that will suppress with some prefactors. So the logarithm is larger than prefactors as well. Some, n log m kind of terms. So I don't see why you cannot have n goes to zero.
Okay, can I move on?
Go ahead and move on.
Yeah.
I don't remember the details.
Yeah, okay, let me go straight forward to the case of what is this in the BP1 state. So the key in this new state is the gapless fermions. So let me just motivate you why we're interested in looking at this problem, because vortex is supposed to be the smoking gun of superfluid. So this is the gapless superfluid, so it's kind of anything interesting happening has to be something to do with the phase, and in this case, there's a coupling between the phase gradient and the current of the gapless fermions. That is actually the new ingredient in this case. Okay. So the key is the gapless fermions. Here is the spectrum for the Bogle-Neuburg quantum particles. There are two branches. Let me just remind you. In particular, we keep this one, because which is gapless in a low energy degree of freedom. So this size of this Fermi surface, we call it bridged ball, actually, it's kind of directly fixed by the polarization, P, where P is defined here. Basically, it depends on the polarization. And there's no other, so it's very straightforward. So basically, the size of the ball is being directly fixed by P. Then first, let's let's just verify the stability. And in this case, we calculate the superfluid density, and everything is positive. And of course, very important point is, when you change the polarization, your superfluid density NS, this is number density, okay, decrease as function of P. And actually, at P equals 0, this is 0.5. This is like the agree with the general understanding with the superfluid, because that's the total number of pairs. Okay, that's the total number of pairs, and the 0.5 the correspond to the total number of pairs. So NS equal to total number of pairs in other case. And the method we used is just this paper. Then our motivation is really want to see, okay, whether the fermions will induce a new turn to modify the interaction between two vortices. Okay, so conventionally we know, because the supercurrent actually will induce a repulsive interaction between two vortices. That actually is, has been studied in many decades, probably before many of us born. So that was known as like a Coulomb potential in 2D will be logarithmic. Okay, and in other case, if the interaction is strong, it's straightforward, repulsive, it's like Coulomb repulsive interaction. You often get the triangular lattice for the for vortices. And the question is how do we include the effect of fermions? And the fermion effect actually is not very. It's not always small. And so let me just set up the method. So we're not going to use the mean field theory. However, we're going to use the effect field theory approach, basically first actually introduced to this problem by Stan Stefanov. And so in this approach, the ground state is assumed, not derived from any microscopic model. Okay, we're not going to rely on those things. So when you assume it's a superfluid, you have the broken symmetry, you can clarify all the low energy degrees freedom indicated by phase phi and the gapless fermion. It's only one branch, that's the psi here. You have those symmetries, you can construct the most general form of the field theory. We are not the first for this particular problem, but of course, this is kind of my background here, is very familiar. So basically, this is the field theory actually already included, in Stefanov's paper when they studied the phase diagram. They did not study the vortices in that paper, okay? That's very important. And those coefficients are not universal. Otherwise, those kind of general ingredients kind of dictated by the symmetries. So I'm not going to explain the detail. In particular, this coefficient is 1. It's because the gain in invariance. So there are many other ways to determine those coefficients. Normally, typically, even in the high energy physics, people know you can determine those non-universal coefficients by comparing your result with the experiments and also, say, many other Monte Carlo calculations. So that's very. There are many standard methods to do that. And yes. Where? You mean C3 or?
Yeah, C3 and the last one.
You mean this one?
Yeah, this one.
So okay, J is the gapless fermion current.
Yes.
Okay, gradient theta is the phase gradient. No, I can write down the formula, but it's not really. There's a current interaction. Okay, this term is very important to need it to make appear in the, as a pair with this fermions to make the whole theory is gaining invariant. Okay.
So the next term is the density interaction.
This is a density interaction. Fermion density.
Okay.
This is like a density because the derivative, time derivative of the phase is the kind of related to the density of the phase. I mean the boson density. I mean the pair density, more precise.
Sorry,
wait.
The superfluid density is.
Superfluid density will kind of proportion to C2. Actually, it's kind of. It's here. Super density is kind of to the tree level. You actually keep renormalize your constants. Actually, that's how you determine.
I had a question about Ludinger theorem kind of?
Oh, Ludinger theorem will fix the, so the density, Ludinger theorem will fix the volume of the Fermi surface, right?
Yeah.
That's actually given by, so this guy, the average of density is fixed by the difference between n up and down in densities. Yeah. So that means you have to, okay, you can go order by order. Is this the expansion in terms of basically it's a knowledge expansion. You go order by order. For any order, you have to go a consistent check to renormalize those coefficients. That's how you make these things work.
But let me, again, just understand. So that you have only one species of fermion.
Yes.
So is there a sum rule in a sense? I take the volume of that Fermi surface and I add to it the superfluid density. Is that the total?
No. This volume is the volume of number difference between up and down. So this is the gapless fermion. This is the Borg-Neuburg quantum particle. A lot of the original fermion.
Okay.
So the original fermion density will be kind of reflect.
Well, so is NS connected to the, is there a relation between it?
There's no direct relation. Okay, there's a constraint. Okay, you can there will be contribution. Okay, this term will contribute to the renormalization of NS.
Trying to understand. So there's some limit where you can imagine bringing the size of the Fermi surface to zero.
Yes.
Getting rid of the broken pairs.
Yes. Then you are told.
At that limit, the superfluid density at zero temperature should equal the particle density.
Here, 0.5.
So there's no such relation.
Why should it be equal? Because there's also excited molecules. There's constant depletion.
That's a different question. I mean, usually the superfluid density at zero temperature in the Galilean invariant.
Well, it's only when you have a gap. When you have
you have fully gap.
You have the sum rule for the Joule weight.
Yeah.
And Joule weight is equal to the superfluid density when
you have the full gap.
That's right. But so I'm imagining thinking about the limit as you approach a gap state. Right?
Yeah.
Then you just become this state.
Because the fermions become infinitely soft in that limit.
That's the question. So is there any preservation of that?
Neil, let me ask you answer a question. Yes, the answer is yes. When you really go into the limit, when the gapless fermions become fully gapped, this is when the P becomes zero. And you recover the 0.5.
Mm-hmm.
This is the 0.5 pairs equal to one of the total density. So you really recover that. So the NS is not the total density. This is very important. Actually, that's the really important ingredient in our result to really tune the relative strengths of two interaction terms. One is the conventional Coulomb term, and the other one is due to the fermion-induced term. So let me just directly jump to the result. So let me just skip this approach. Basically, all the vortices physics will be described by the gauge field, assuming the vortex are parallel in the z-direction, and so effectively become two-dimensional. And what we found is that the total potential. So after the whole setup, you have a Lagrangian, you know how to calculate it, so it's automatic now. That's what the Vladimir test we checked. So we found the two terms, okay? So the total potential between two vortices, okay? It's like in the same charge, the same vorticity. The total potential consists of two contributions. One is the conventional Coulomb term. It's purely repulsive. This is in the momentum space, okay? This is actually kind of proportion to the NS, okay? And however, there's a new term because you have plenty of gapless fermions. Unlike the D-wave or P-wave superfluid, you have a full Fermi sphere, surface. There are plenty of knowledge excitations of fermionic, like. And they will contribute the new term is also 1 over Q squared with this numerator actually depends on Q. And when Q goes to zero, actually this numerator is not zero, it's finite. And the negative, it's very important. It's a minus sign of this guy. So it's the opposite sign. So P is negative, always negative. And it's also finite when Q equals zero. Okay. And yes, you already jumped ahead, you concluded it. So because of the fermion presence, you would imagine you should speculate before you do any calculation, some Friedel or / RKK oscillations, already many people who fermion is in the metals. When you put the magnetic impurity in the metals, you expect these situations, for example. So let me just review this for those people who are not familiar, for example, from the atomic gases community. So when you put magnetic impurities in the background of, say, in a metal, because the metals consist of electrons, free electrons, for example, And you will see, you can, the free electrons will induce the long-range interaction actually between the between two spins. This interaction is in the J of R. It will be oscillate in space. And that actually oscillation scale is really set by this mean-like structure right here. And we actually what we found is very similar. Let me just skip this part. What we found actually, you have a, let me go back a little bit. Look at this potential. The first term strength is really controlled by NS. The second term actually controlled by the size of the Fermi surface. If I have more Fermi surface, I mean, if I have more larger Fermi surface, means you have large contributions from the fermions. And by changing the polarization, NS is decaying. Okay? Large P means smaller NS. Large P means large Fermi surfaces. So the second term will go over. So that at some point, actually, the second term can take over. So that's exactly this precise in the physical meaning why. So you can have three different regimes. When you think about the potential in the real space, in the very small polarization, nothing very strange. The Coulomb potential dominates. The conventional Coulomb potential dominates. I will not plot the figure here. So you just have a conventional physics. Nothing strange. But however, in the intermediate regime, according to the polarization P, you find out that, okay, in the short distance, the potential is repulsive, dominated by the Coulomb potential, but actually it's kind of become negative, I mean, become attractive at some point. That's actually the minimum, also oscillate. And this oscillation actually is not like a 2KF oscillation, because in this case, unlike the RKKY or Friedel oscillation, the oscillation is really, okay, this kind of induced coupling between two vertices is really through the current correlations, okay? In the RKKY and the Friedel oscillations, in other case, the interaction between two, say, spins are kind of is induced by the charge-charge correlations, by the density correlations. Okay, so it's very different. In this case, there's no RPA corrections because I'm not going to because of the symmetry actually. Yeah. Okay, if you go to very strong polarization, the system will collapse. I mean, maybe, but that's actually beyond because our theory will stop becoming valid at some short distance. So we can't really sure what really happens when you go to really low distance. This is low energy field theory. Okay, so that is the general results, and I think it's quite interesting on its own regard. This may indicate a new possibility for the vortex lattice because this oscillation feature. Yes.
So in fact, you have both density and the current.
The density does not contribute to the interaction between two vortices because the vortices are the phase gradient. So there's no, you have to through the current channel, not the density channel. So it has come to the phase gradient, yeah.
It's not 2KF, but it's
not 2KF. Definitely when K, when the large Fermi will be a shorter distance, but it's not so, because we do not have, it's much more complicated than the RKKY case.
Okay, roughly, is it the order KF?
I think it's like from 2 to 10 or 20, depends on the, it's not universal. Depends on the delta and the total mu bars, those kind of numbers. Yes. For example, you can change this minima by changing the delta, also the polarization. So we don't have analytical formula. This is like a numerical plot. That is the problem we can't. Okay, I can speculate, but I could be wrong. So I already made one mistake in the past. Probably like a bit more.
Why the fermion induced
the
interaction between vortices in the attractive?
We spent a long, enormous time trying to understand. We still have not found a very intuitive calculation, I mean a picture. But I can assure you, if you are familiar with the passenger girl, since I know you very well, the induced interaction is attractive. If you, if you just play a little bit, it will really, three lines I can show you why this current, but okay, the induced interaction is really given by this current correlator. We spent, actually, Jan Beck and Vladimir, we spent enormous time trying to figure out how to understand, but it looks like no.
If this kind of Casimir effect is like background mediates, I mean, the environment mediates interaction between objects, except that in this case, environment is fermionic instead of bosonic, but yeah. It is related in some sense.
Also, this is the Coulomb-Coulomb interaction, so I think it's something to do with the area Coulomb-Coulomb interaction to be attractive. I don't know. It's not
big. We spend a number of days all the time to think about.
And when you have a vortex and an anti-vortex, the same interaction, or does the fermion?
The fermion, I mean, the sign will be switched.
Even for
the interaction. So, Yeah, okay, the site will be preserved. I mean, so okay, the ferment induced will become repulsive. So this is different.
What does Corwell behave like a pinning center for the extra fermion? So suppose we forget about the vortex, just we prepare some local potential like impurity.
Yes.
What's the induced interaction between these two impurities from the fermion is still attractive? I'm not sure whether it's related
so to actually,
or just something, you put anything into the fermion stuff, into a fermion state, you induce some attractive.
What do you point out is a very interesting problem, actually. I saw a little bit, but actually nobody, as far as I know, has studied this problem. Fermion core states within this vortex, you already have some kind of gapless, so they could be already extended. How these core states in the like say corona degen state kind of related to this? I mean, the gapless is already extended, so it's kind of. You mean core state is solid phase transition? I think it's still there because you have a fully gapped one. I don't have a good answer now because nobody has really studied this problem. I think it's new.
It's not in that effective.
Yeah,
the core size is zero.
Yeah.
It's a point like
you have to go to some microscope model like a BDG, like to really analyze the problem.
But the fact that the sign of this interaction switches when you switch from vortex to anti-vortex suggests that the fact that it's a vortex is important, right?
But
the impurity.
Yeah.
Well, if the vortex and anti-vortex become repulsive.
Yes, anti-vortex will become fermion turn will become repulsive. Okay. Yeah. Let me because I have a lot of topic. Actually, related to what we did together. So let me talk about it. Let me just summarize now. Okay, let me just quickly move to the second topic. Any questions before I move on to the, any more questions before I move on to the second topic? Okay, let me completely change the gear. So now I move to the lattice, since lattice has been as vibrating as the Fischbein resonance in the last four or five years. So this part of the topic actually is based on the work I've done with the following people, actually with Kunjun Wu, my long-term friend and colleague, and Joe Mo and Shankar, who is here, right here. Let me start with the pointing out the following. Actually, there's a recently emerged interest on this p-band bosons, basically the p-orbital bosons on the lattice. Okay, I must give the priority to other. Although our work are independent in the beginning, but I still want to point out the priority to the other two groups, basically Isaacson and Girvan, also Kugelhopf, in the context of the cold atoms. Okay, so almost in the, in particular, Kugelhopf is in almost in the same time when we had the same ideas.
Priority for what?
Yeah, to get interest in these problems. Yes. So the. I mean, in the context of the cold atoms, not on the more general context. Yeah. So, okay, let me just give you my own motivation why we get interested in this p-band physics. First we want to look beyond the S-band, since many, beyond the S-band and the spin models on the lattice with cold atoms, because many physics has been studied and there's already a lot of understanding, many interesting phases already discovered. And our interest is really try to explore the orbital degeneracy. Degeneracy means symmetry or some conservation laws. So that's the new physics part. In particular, the p orbital is so interesting in the sense the p orbitals are anisotropic. So you may think about anisotropy is a problem, but actually you can look a lot around as a new feature. So in this conference, actually a few 2 weeks ago, I think people talking about the dipolar gases and molecules interacting with dipolar interactions. In other case, you already see people already interested in the anisotropy induced by the interactions. In this case, the anisotropy is induced by the hopping. Okay, the interaction will be okay, still kind of more or less isotropic. And since also it's very popular to say quantum simulation of condensed matter problems, this is also possible to use this new setup to simulate orbital-related problem in the condensed matter. So this is speculated. It's completely, but it's a motivation, okay? Also, most importantly, there are new experiments. So that's the make physics different from other, some other pure theory studies. Okay. So since I don't have that much time, I'm not going into the detail about this experiment, since this is more like a research talk. So there are various ways to populate the P-band. Okay. Actually, already like different groups like Phillips and Porto and the Brohis groups, etc. There's a very important problem associated with the P-band. That is the decay problem, because the P-band is not supposed to be the lowest band if you really solve the one-dimensional two-body problem or one-body problem in any given potential. So it's a it's actually a single particle problem. So for a given potential, then you will think, okay, the P-band is not the really, it cannot be the ground state. So this decay problem, this was first studied, those kind of decay process, like you have two particles. Suppose you are using one of the three methods I showed in the previous slides by other people invented. You populate the P-band. Suppose the two particles in the P-band collide, and the one is going up to the upper band, and another one goes down. So eventually, your P-band will deplete. This was first considered in the Isaacson and Govern's paper. So there's a decay problem. And suggest one mechanism is that you want to introduce the double well potentials to really reduce the whole problem to a two-band problem. And so the energy, we call this energy blocking mechanism, you really, really can stabilize those two guys, say, in this P-band, because there's no way to jump. This is the one possibility. However, the nature is always kind to the theorist. Actually, it's more interesting to know that actually what Brohis told me, he already had a new paper 2 weeks ago, I think in April, this new paper. And in fact, he showed actually the lifetime without any double is already very long. This is the, let me just work with you in this diagram. This is the time in the units of the tunneling time between nearest labor, okay, in that scale. This is like a light steps in X direction. You can see actually the time, lifetime can be long, like it's 100 times longer than the tunneling time. So this is very encouraging. And what he told me, the key to the slow decay is kind of because the lattice potential is not really what you're thinking. It's not really harmonic. So it's a really good feature. So anyway. And now let me go into the real physics part based on what we did, actually. So let me show you what's the P-band Bose-Hubbard model. We basically started with the microscope model, turn on the lattice potentials. Basically, we derived this model. The detail was given in our paper, in this PIA paper. The important things I want to talk about here is that first, you look at the potential, I mean the interactions. You have the conventional interaction term. This is like a short-range interaction. It's an on-site interaction. This is like a density operator. This is the angular momentum L, okay? And the sign in front of the angular momentum interaction is minus. This indicates the interaction, assuming the interaction is repulsive, okay? This means the interaction between two orbital states is kind of free orbital or free magnetic, depends on what you like to call. And this is very important. Another ingredient, new ingredient associated with P-band is that the hopping is kind of anisotropic. Okay, this is like in quantum chemistry, like a sigma and the pi bonds. So there are two kinds of hoppings, and one is actually the signs are different. It's head to tail. That's like a shoulder to shoulder tunneling. It's like kind of so the magnitude is also different because of the overlap integrals. Yes.
That's the equation for H. So you have delta mu nu on the left, but then you have b dagger mu.
So mu refers to? Mu runs over px, py, pz, or x, y, z, three different orbital states.
But the only place mu appears is r in the direction of hopping, you're saying, right? So that's how I should read
this. You say again, this is nu?
Yeah, the nu only appears
nu
there.
Nu is here.
Uh-huh.
Oh, this one, this is like a serious way to write this whole thing, very complicated term. But actually, basically what we're talking about for each P, okay, think about the PX orbital, they're separate. So this guy can tunnel this way with a T parallel. And if tunnel in another way or in the Z direction, we'll just have the magnitude of T perpendicular. That's all.
Okay, but it's some kind of a
it's just a
way of writing this.
Yeah, it's a shorthand notation. It's kind of neat, but it's kind of otherwise not very, it's not a manifest, but that was really short. Yeah. Now let me just suppose you start with the dilute Bose gas with weak interaction, repulsive interaction. So what do we expect? Of course, you expect Bose condensation. And when you think about the Bose condensation, the condensation will be determined by the band minima. So you find out the band, where is the band structure, right? So you find out the problem and solve the problem, you find out, okay, this is the p-band, unlike the s-band, and the band minima, say, for the px orbital state happens to be in those places, pi 0, 0. And the other, like py will be in the 0, pi 0. So likewise for the pz, okay? And so any, you have three different points because those two points are identical in the Brillouin zone. So you can condense any one of the three points as far as the kinematic turn is concerned, or the minimas. And those three momentum is indicated by here. So you can make a superposition of any one of the three states. Okay? And the energy actually will select which one is going to. Okay? And so since we're talking about the you have three orbital states, three kind of bosons. Okay, it's like a spin one physics on this regard. So I can unite all my orbital fields into a column. So this is like spin one field, it's a complex. So I only need six real variables to parameterize the whole field. I introduce this way because this makes the symmetry obvious. You can use many other ways, like Higgins 3, people would use other ways to, you can do the same thing. Whatever you're using, I can map to my own language to do exactly the same. And what do you find? What we found is that the U for repulsive U will select the state is like a px plus ipy state. And in particular, this chi is this parameter associated with the time reversal symmetry. Actually, the plus minus indicates that actually the time reversal symmetry is broken. Okay. So this is the state that will break the time reversal symmetry, also break the rotation, and of course, it's a superfluid break the U1 symmetry. You can, with the knowledge in the momentum space, you can map out the real space configuration. That's like a kindergarten knowledge. So you map out, so what you found out, because you just remember, in the Hamiltonian, the system favors ferromagnetic order, okay? So that actually, in this particular choice, actually LZ is finite, okay? There are many other degenerate states on the degenerate manifold, so the symmetry is spontaneously chosen orientation, okay? So that means, okay, if you, in this particular state I showed last, so LZ is finite, LY, LX are all zero. In this case, a very important situation I want to point out is that, okay, LZ actually changes signs, alternates from plus to minus, minus plus. Minus plus, all the way. And this alternation only happens in the XY plane, not in the Z direction. That's why we call it TSOC. Okay. So this is like the one of the state. Let me, since I don't have that much time, let me just move on. Okay, by the way, okay, let me just give you the predictions. And the one of the remarkable predictions is that the condensate is at the finite momentum. So you will see actually the in a time of flight experiment, you will see the coherence peak at the finite momentum. In this case, actually, it will be in like 1 and 3 in this unit. Okay. And this actually was kind of, by the way, this similar, I mean, related rays are not exact same, kind of can be inferred from those independent studies. By the way, those predictions actually directly agree with the recent experimental work by Bloch's group. You can see they peak at 3, 1, 1, 3. Okay, that's exactly what's been seen. And what they measured is like they measured the lifetime. They also see the coherence peak, etc. So I'm not going to do the detail. Now let me move on to the next subtopic in the B topic, that is the p-band on the triangular lattice. In this case, you have more frustrations. So in this case, the Hamiltonian on the for the interaction part is the same. I mean, except we talk about only two orbital states on the two-dimensional triangular lattice, okay? So you only have px, py, or orbitals. We don't worry about the pz. Suppose the pz is high-gapped. And in this case, because the parallel tunneling is much stronger than the transverse tunneling, and unlike the square lattice or cubic lattice case, you don't really need the transverse tunneling to establish coherence, okay? Because the triangle has this kind of orientation. The bonds are not really straight, you know, it's kind of 6 degrees. So that means for the simplicity, you just take care of this part. That's all you need in the beginning. And you have three different orientations to tunnel, three different bond directions, and indicated by P1, P2, P3 states. And all those states can be decomposed into PX, PYs. Okay, you only need, your basis is only two states. Then, so I mean, suppose you start a weak coupling, that means the U is much smaller than T, okay? In other case, you are expecting a Bose condensate. And again, you play the same game, find out the band structure, find out where is the minimum. So then you're already done. So basically that's the, so you find out, okay, the band minimum, this is the Bernoulli zone, the band minimum will be given by this K1, K2, K3. They are located on those 3 points, okay? And those 3 points means there are 3 different states, okay? Those 3 states will give you same kinematic energy, no difference. They all the same minima, degenerate. And you can map those 3 states in the real space, and the 3 states will be look like this. So you can already see the orientation of the orbitals. Those are the 3 states. And so they are the same in the energy as far as the kinematic term is concerned. And again, the interaction will select which superposition will be the best. Okay. So what do you find? You have a huge degenerate basically you have a huge degenerate manifold of states. They're all related by the symmetry. So this is the one particular state. It's basically you condense to K2, K3 with equal weight. Okay, and that actually corresponds to a unequal weight between Px and Py. So this is the real configuration, real space configuration. And what you find out, okay, on the lattice, you'll find out, okay, the LZ is not zero. Again, because the interaction is very orbital, it's very magnetic, that is. So that means you need to find, you're basically system favors to find the LZ, okay. And however, because of the tunneling is stronger than the interaction, actually the tunneling doesn't really want to have the LZ to be the biggest. So it's kind of, actually the weight in X is larger than the Y. So one of the very important point I want to mention is that actually this direction indicates the sign of the LZ. You can think about it as orbital current. It's like a Px plus IPY on each side, okay, or Px minus IPY on the side. So this arrow indicates the orbital current, actually also tells you the sign of LZ. And you can see this change the sign from one row to another row, unlike the square lattice or cubic lattice we studied. So this is this quantum stripe order, Shank and Jomo and when I would like to talk about this one. So this is like the stripe order, since I only have 5 minutes. So basically, this state, of course, also breaks the time reversal symmetry, translational and the rotational symmetry. And you break some orbital symmetry because you have 3 degenerate orbital states. There's kind of, they're not completely internal, but somehow mimic like spin one symmetry. I mean, spin one boson symmetry in other sense, but not exactly the same. And of course, the charge, I mean, the stripe order is not a new name in the condensed matter. People already discovered the stripe order in the context of, say, Hightees cuprates, also in the quantum Hall states, I mean, in the quantum Hall systems. So, however, those stripe orders are not the same as here. So this is like an orbital moment ordering, showing some kind of stripe order. It's not the charge, okay? This is different. And actually, the stripe order is found in all carbonates. I just told you how to do that in the weak carbon. Everybody can do that. It's just weak carbon B, C, and the mean field theory is actually already quite well. And what we found actually is that actually in the all carbonates, solar system is in the superfluid, you have the stripe order. The difference is given by this so-called mixed angle, alpha. And you can translate that wave function I plotted with the real configurations in this formula. I mean, translate to this formula. And you have this U1 phase, and you have this PX-PY mixture. And sigma here indicates the Eisen variable on each largest side, okay? Alpha will tell you the ratio of this mixture. That is the, and in the weak carbonate, alpha is actually pi over 6. In the strong carbonate, actually, alpha becomes pi over 4. This is very different. I mean, this is the kind of smoothly connected if you trust the mean field theory. So how do we deal with the strong carbonate? Because you can do a controlled calculation in the weak carbonate. You can also do a reasonably controlled calculation, I would say, in the strong carbonate. So because in the strong carbonate, you can imagine the following. Okay, you have a small local condensate on each lattice site, and the U is very large. So U favors when U is quite large, okay, the sign in front of L, Z squared is kind of negative. So you have sign, it's very magnetic. So you have a orbital moment associated with that. So you can assign a Eisen variable on each lattice side, okay? And also you have a phase. So in other case, you can map that problem to this U1 gauge symmetry. It's like a classical you want gauge theory. And the difference here is that you have this, without this A term, without this gauge field, actually this is already very familiar. With this A term, historically, is already also studied. So this A is the external gauge field provided by the isovariables, actually, by the staggering, or whatever you want, because the isovariables can any direction up or down, right? And so those are the phase. So as far as those phase concerned, they see this gauge field induced by the isovariables. And this isovariable is due to the time reversal symmetry. Keep that in mind. Phase is associated with the U1 symmetry. So they're not the same thing. They're not smoothly collected. They're physically not the same thing. So you can't say, I just want to absorb that part into my phi by redefinition. That's impossible. It's different physics. And I cannot basically, this whole theory will tell you, OK, if you sum over A along the Clapeyard, say, triangle, it cannot be equal 0, mod 1. Because if you just draw a simple triangle, unlike the square lattice, you can have different configuration plus, plus, or minus, or any other way, say plus, minus, minus. None of those, you cannot make a zero. It's always frustrated. That's the exact reason why this flux is always finite. It's not a zero, mod 1. For the square lattice, you can make it zero, up, down, it's kind of disappeared, right? So this is impossible. That's actually essential physics why it is an external flux. And you can map this gauge theory, this is like a duality mapping, many people know it very well, to the U1. For the vortex part, you can map it to the Coulomb gas problem with some kind of external flux. And you conclude that the system wants to minimize the flux at each lattice site. By that end, you really find out the best way to minimize the total flux, I mean, on each side, is basically have this stripe order. So that's actually your, so in a strong company, you really conclude with 100%, I mean, as far as you trust the theory, this in this limit, you really you are really confident that, okay, in this strong company limit, the system is really stripe ordered also. So with these two limits determined with confidence, you really don't really have to do some mean field if you allow me, but actually still, we did some goodwill mean field calculations. Is all due to congruence contribution in this case particular. So basically, you can really see this is the phase diagram based on mean field calculation. So you recover the model state. You actually see the stripe order, the superfluid. So the superfluid is not the conventional superfluid in the sense that you have the stripe order. Okay. So you can, okay, it's already out of time. So you can also make predictions. And this is the prediction to show where you can see the peaks in the time of flight, but does not really tell you have the stripe. Okay, maybe we need other way to detect the stripes. You need some maybe correlations. But again, you can see this kind of triangular lattice origin structure. It's not like the square lattice. You can see this kind of structure at some kind of incommensurate if you just look at the square lattice. So you have seen this kind of the peaks at some kind of incommensurate wave vectors. And let me just summarize the normal features in my own mind regarding the lattice p-band Bose-gas. So first of all, it's kind of a new kind of Bose condensate in the sense that the condensate is not at zero momentum. So also in the triangle lattice, we show that you can have some quantum orbital stripe ordering. And this is quite interesting on its own right. You can have a rich set of broken symmetries. That means that you could have a lot of different kinds of topological defects. In another sense, you may have many non-trivial excitations and some others I'm not going to speculate more. One thing I want to point out, more than I said here, is that this system is also different from the Hinton 3 superfluid. When you're talking about the P wave, the first thing jumping in your mind is, okay, Hinton 3 is P wave superfluid. However, Hinton 3 P wave really means the P wave of the relative motion of two fermions, I mean, within a pair. This is the P wave of the center of mass motion, one single boson. Okay? And this P wave, if it happens to be at some moment, will show up as a modulation in the real space, like the scattering, I mean staggering or stripe ordering. But in the Hinton 3 P wave, it's a different story. So this is very different. So what about the future? I already said a little bit. So I guess I should stop here. And thank you very much for your attention.
will there be a similar story if you go to a higher bands, like from P to D or something like that?
For P, or maybe for F, or G or F. For D, okay, I would think okay, D would be, there could be some similarity. However, D, the hopping for D will be isotropic if I take some kind of D orbitals. Okay, you have 5 D orbitals. So, like the dx squared minus y squared, the hopping in the x, y direction will be the same, right? The magnitude. The reason we didn't really think more about D is because the D may not be as stable as the P because you kind of get the approach to the top of the lattice. But otherwise, I don't think why. Maybe it's also interesting. So.
If the orbit was in the square lattice, the energy level would be significant.
Yeah.
The general say that
would be
broken.
Well, yeah, actually, we'll break into two groups.
The P over the zero, that the general would be broken.
Oh, in square lattice.
But in the triangular lattice it will be broken, right? So the assumption is that your U has to be larger than this breaking of the degeneracy. Why? Why not?
You can
have the triangular lattice, so maybe there will be, because you have an unharmonic potential, there will be a breaking of the degeneracy?
For the real, I mean for the simplified harmonic oscillator, the D, you have 5 degenerate states. But
this is unharmonic. You pointed out the
important. Yeah, unharmonic. For the harmonic, I'm not sure how you handle that problem. But in the condensed matter, people usually know you have this T2G, E2G split in between. So basically, the d orbital states are split into two groups.
Yes, but also in the case of the p waves, that the idea in principle there's a small unharmonic term that will cause a splitting, and the assumption I guess is simply that the u that you have is large enough.
If you have different confinement, if you have different lattice potential in the z direction,
right.
Then the.
It's not really that
probably it's still a two-dimensional representation with six-fold symmetry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As long as you have six-fold, that degeneracy is okay.
Can I ask another question? Okay. So when you go to the P states, are you saying that you have to do some sort of a cooling in order to go to these kind of states that you describe here? So how would you actually make them, prepare them?
I think actually, okay, let me just quote what's shown by Bloch's experimental picture here. So actually, I don't know what they probably know more than I do. So what they did actually, I think in the beginning, in the initial time, it's not coherent. So they already populated the p-band, but it's kind of broadly distributed in the moment space. And the way it actually, I don't know what happened actually in the middle. So it's like just, I don't think there's any, how do you take away the heat? So that's the.
That's exactly what I'm asking.
Yeah, I don't know how to take away the heat. So I think it's like, I don't know what's the real mechanism.
Is it an adiabatic loading or an explicit cooling? Because if you do explicit cooling, then I would expect there should be nonetheless some relaxation of the ground state.
I think it's more like a.
It's a very simplest adiabatic cooling. They're very proud of it. Obviously, something.
No, but you have to sort of adiabatically load from the center, the lowest block,
yeah,
and then the other one. So.
It might be some adiabatic loading.
Yeah,
but if doing this, you have to transfer the momentum. So which state do you pick at the end? Because you.
No, when you prefer the initial state, you have to see the momentum distribution is kind of broad. This is the initial time.
But this sounds like incoherent cooling, right? Not adiabatic.
You mean,
loading.
What's the question?
What lattice is this?
This is the square lattice. I mean, cubic lattice, I think. Actually, it's the only px band. This only one has a px band. It's actually a square lattice. I mean, it's a cubic lattice, but actually, we only select the px band. So the px band is the lowest in this case because they have less. So, okay, the depths in the. Basically, the px band is lower than the py and the pz. So, in this particular experiment.
In this experiment, is the lattice potential high? Or, as far as just the shape of that second band, it'll look like that probably, even in the nearly free approximation, right? Just with Bragg reflection. You can't really think of it as a p orbital per se.
What do you mean? No, actually the lattice potential is not flat. Actually it's like 10 times the recoil energy or higher.
It's pretty high here.
Yeah, it's not small. You can already see the band structure. That's actually what they checked. When they really try to map out this one, it's like it become free particles. That's why they can identify the second the second band with the extended Bernoulli zone.
This
section is a three-dimensional lattice. However, you only have a pxO state.
Okay, so it's an effective 1D.
So the tunneling. So basically, the px state is lower than the py and pz.
So that is not really your situation, I would say.
It's not yet. Right now the most.
That's much harder.
Right. Because right now, what's the claim in our paper, I think the most important is that they can demonstrate the lifetime of the p-band is very long, and also show that in one band, the system can move from this initial configuration to the configuration that actually the state will condense at some fine, at one particular momentum point. That's on the edge. So that's all they show. It's not really, it's not what we're talking about yet.
The number of higher bands, how many higher bands are there that are still bound in the potential?
The required energy is 10. I mean, the Vx is 10 times ER. So you can think how many bands.
So higher band probably.
You can tell, people already do some calculations, how many. I definitely need one more band. I think actually is in this paper, I think in one of this paper, maybe in this thesis of Murray, they showed actually the next band 110. There's a population. I think it's in this band, in this paper, in this new archive paper.
This is 100.
So this is 100. They also show there's a population in the 110.
They need a special, a different preparation.
Yeah, I mean they showed the population in another one also. So that's the. So definitely there's a lot of band above. Yeah. So I think probably those bands here.
I have a quick question for the first half of your talk.
Yes.
So what role does temperature play, in that? Because, at what temperature is any of that physically visible?
You mean for the first topic?
First half, yes.
To see the new form of the vortex potential? What the temperature, right?
Right.
Oh, okay.
You talked about the zero temperature calculation, which is
right.
Fine.
Right.
But
the temperature scale will be in the order of, say, so long your temperature is below let me back up a little bit. Okay, so the typical situation is the energy scale in our theory will be the delta.
It's delta.
Okay, delta is in the order of EF, basically 0.5 EF or 0.6 EF. So EF is the Fermi energy. So long your physics, delta plays like the momentum. I mean the energy scale. So our theory has to be compared. So all the known is compared with the delta. Okay, so our prediction will be valid so long you are in the temperature scale much lower than delta.
Right, obvious, but do you have some idea what that must be? Is that 0.1 is much lower?
I think actually no, let me back up a little bit. So there are a few complications. Because right now, most of experiments, actually probably all, are kind of associated with the resonance region where interaction is very strong. So in other case, you can high temperature. People already achieve like it's 0.02, TF or this kind of thing. So you're already really in very low temperatures, like TF is the measure, right? So it's like TF is the Fermi energy, Fermi temperature. So people can achieve like a nano Kelvin.
0.2 TF, I'm a solid state physicist, is very high temperature.
Right, but this is already nano Kelvin.
These systems are incredibly high temperature systems, they're not low temperature
right.
systems.
Exactly.
It also, we routinely have 10 to the power minus 6 TF.
Right, so back to you.
That's my context, you see.
Yeah, this is very important because if I draw the phase diagram in the 1 over KF. Okay, so this is like a BCS, BEC. And our prediction, so this is like a phase diagram made by Razhovsky et al. So this will be the polarization. So the BP1 state, is right here. So in this window, the interaction is weaker. So you are supposed to be going to a lower temperature to really see the superfluid state. That will be lower than the current temperature.
Right. So my worry is that the theory is beautiful. It may be quite academic at this stage because this is very far in the future.
No.
You have to go to.
No. Because suppose people already realize the superfluid here phase separation. This is the phase separation state, and you just move to here. Those temperature scale will be very comparable.
Really? I see.
Because the BP1 will start from here all the way approaching the resonance region. You don't have to be on the really weak side, because on the weak side I worry about that as much as you do, because it's really low.
I'm not sure that's true, but that's a good point.
Yeah, because this you can just sit here and do the experiments.
So
So what do they need to do? Just detuning a little bit more on this
now,
molecular side.
What about the oscillatory structure that you're talking about? I think it's a bit confusing to bring up even RKKY in that context. I think the audience was confused. It really probably has nothing to do with RKKY. But in any case, did you look
I like at that because that means more. Huh?
Did you? I mean, is there a way you can look at the temperature dependence of that object?
I think actually for the temperature, okay, it's like a K divided by delta. So any effect will be, okay, we did not, must say, we
but
did not look at the temperature.
For example, RKKY, one can calculate that, right?
Yeah. So we have not studied that one. So I probably, however, I want to point out one very important thing associated with the temperature because, okay, you have Gapitz fermions. In the true zero temperature, like Bugak, Ori Bugak and then my friend Michael Forbes wrote a paper indicating, okay, you're going to have a P wave pairing. Because they have a Fermi surface, they are unstable. Okay, so there will be kind of induced interaction actually turns out favor with the P parent. So that will be in a weak channel in a much lower temperature. So our calculations on the zero temperature, but were applicable for the temperature above that P wave TC is not, that will be I think it will be much lower. So
now this oscillatory structure that you're talking about, which comes from the current channel.
Yes.
It's basically some kind of a current bubble, I guess, right? I mean,
yes, just one bubble.
So then that you should be able to calculate. I mean, that's no more difficult than calculating density.
That's what I didn't show here.
I have made my, you know,
yeah.
Pretty well
so it's automatic.
I can calculate.
Yeah,
definitely able to calculate.
Yeah, it's automatic.
The version is a lot more complicated.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is. So it's a more complicated integral. But you know, that's how it is.
So that's why we kind of get an analytical form.
So I think that it's very good.
So I believe the calculation is straightforward. There's no way to make a mistake in general. So because it's very standard, right? So so thank you very much for the comments.
So actually, there is another energy scale, which is the Fermi energy of unpaired Fermi.
Yeah. That's the size of the Fermi surface.
That can be much smaller than both the gap and the original Fermi energy. So this oscillation will be tied to that energy scale.
Yes.
Yeah, that is correct.
So then
yes,
the
but it's not so.
Which would be worse?
Yeah, and then one is dead if that is the case.
So can I just make a comment on this origin of the Sharpen interaction that you guys were talking about?
Yes.
So, well, there are maybe two different ways to think about it. We know that, you didn't mention that, but there is an FFLO phase somewhere.
Yes.
And the basic physics of the FFLO physics is that when you have a spontaneous supercurrent, for example, it makes it easier to accommodate the unpaired majority spin particles.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have, well, of course, it's not in your ground state, but once you have the vortex, you have this current orbiting around the vortex, and if you have another vortex and move them closer together, you get more of this orbiting current. So basically, I think it's that physics that is maybe partially responsible for the
but still, I kind of see the sign why it's...
No, I mean, when you have them closer together, what is the closer together, you get more current. More screening current, more supercurrent.
You get more supercurrent means the stronger repulsive in the interaction?
No, I mean, you get repulsion from the superfluid sector, but
yes,
from the fermions, more current is good. It breaks the pairs and accommodates the interaction more easily. That's the
so it's like the tendency going towards flow state.
Well, I
mean, I think
that's a tendency, but it has a similar origin.
Yeah.
Want some current, some spontaneous current.
Right. That could be a good point. I have to think about this. yeah? But
it's attractive when they have the same circulation, isn't it?
Yeah. So they're attractive for the same circulation, which enhances the current, but they're repulsive for the opposite circulation, which kills the current when you move them close together.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's actually, it's all about
being
related to this Amperian interaction.
But because there are some problems to understand.
We have, say, two currents moving in parallel,
then
you have
attractive
interaction.
Well, depends on whether you're talking about current in between or outside.
Yeah, sure.
When it's outside, you have more space, right?
I forgot what we had, but we had this idea, but we abandoned because of some issues with this picture, I mean. I think I forgot. Do you remember what's the reason why we abandoned this picture?
We
must have some, because we had this picture, definitely. Somehow we abandoned because there's some problems and some other issues to understand why. So this argument doesn't go through for many other things also. So, but I forgot now, it's already.
So, well, this oscillation,
yeah.
The important thing is that 2K app singularity in the current kernel chamber is much weaker.
Yes.
So when you do the Fourier transform, it doesn't really pick up the 2K app directly. Mm-hmm. So actually, you know, you're actually probing the much larger area.
Yes. Yeah.
That's why the dependence oscillation is much more complicated. I think that's basically what happens.
When you integrate it out, it's going to be actually a two-dimensional Fourier surface or three-dimensional?
It's a three-dimensional Fourier surface. The vortices are two-dimensional. I mean, the parallel, so it's like the interaction will be two-dimensional.
So for the surface, you treat
three-dimensional. So what we treat is actually very live. We did not talk about the core states. The vortices will modify the fermionic states, right? In principle, once you have vortices, you actually will modify the you modify the fermionic state. What we take is just like the spectrum, which are. You can, why not? You can, why it's also, that's actually a lot of topic we're gonna try to study like in two dimension, how this will modify the constellated solid phase transition. Because you can't just directly map to a cooling gas. It's no longer truly cooling yet. There's a new term. Because the KD transition is all based on the coolant gas physics. So that's the, I don't know, it's like speculation.
So that non-zero temperature.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I mean, the nature of the oscillations will be slightly different.
Because the sign is different. So, you know, because the signs can be opposite to the cooling gas sign. It's like an attractive interaction.
Long range part of the potential at non-zero temperature can only come from something long range. The only thing that give you a long-range tail, is
because this long-range, not very long, but with sufficient distance, the interaction is still attractive. You can see the...
At zero temperature, but not at...
Oh, you mean the finite temperature, okay.
At non-zero, that Coswell status is non-zero temperature physics, right? So it's...
Mm-hmm.
Please send me an email if you want to join for dinner. I'd like to make reservations.